its Ideasphere with environment writer for the San Jose Mercury News and managing editor for KQED, Paul Rogers, and climate change scientist director for the National Resource Defense Council, Dan Lassoff.
We are changing the climate by loading up our atmosphere with heat-trapping carbon dioxide and other pollutants. And we're seeing the effects of that in different ways, in different places, and at different times. But the basic trend is towards warmer temperatures overall, when you look at the globe as a whole, towards more intense storms and more severe droughts.
California has experienced a few rainy days lately, but as you may have been reading, that in no way means the end of the drought for the West. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with environment writer for the San Jose Mercury News, Paul Rogers. I also talk with climate scientist director for the National Resource Defense Council Climate and Clean Air Program, Dan Lassoff. Mr. Rogers joins me for the opening segment. Thanks so much for taking this time.
Thank you.
Let's look at the drought. We got a little bit of rain in the state of California. Obviously, the rainfall is considerably less than desirable, but it's there. However, in your article recently for the San Jose Mercury News, you're reporting that the State Water Project is withdrawing their distribution of water to residents and farmers this year?
Yes, for the first time in its 54-year history, they're predicting that the State Water Project will be providing no water to farms or cities.
This doesn't mean cities and counties are going to be cut off, but it does mean that they have to rely on their own resources.
Exactly. It means that everybody in the state is essentially on their own with local supply. So most farmers and most urban areas have groundwater supplies. They pump water from wells. Many also have other sources. They have stored water in their own reservoirs, many of them. They have built recycled water plants. In some cases, a few have built desal plants. There are lots of other places to get water, including conservation. But it is quite symbolic and quite important that this backbone of the statewide water system just doesn't have enough to give yet this year.
Most of us thinking of the state of California imagine the northern portion of the state does not have the drought the rest of the state has, and especially central California and southern. But it is a situation that you mention it, snowfall. There's less than 20% this year?
Yeah, the entire Sierra Nevada snowpack right now is at 15% of normal. And almost all of the state of California is now affected by severe drought. There is an agency called the U.S. Drought Monitor, which is a collaboration of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other agencies, and they do an update every Thursday. They have a website, and they put states and counties in different colors, and nearly all of California is now in red under that system.
There was an article you wrote, published again in the San Jose Mercury News, showing that through the history of the state, we have had 100-year droughts, and there's no way of knowing if this is going to be a 2-, 3-, 4-year, or even 7-year drought, or one of those extended.
Yeah, it's quite eye-opening when you see the science that researchers have done at places like UC Berkeley and other universities. They study tree rings, as a lot of people know. When you cut a tree down, you can measure the age of the tree by counting the number of rings, and you can also measure whether you had a wet year or a dry year. In wetter years, the rings are wider because the tree grew more. And so scientists who study this stuff, and they also study sediments and other geologic measurements, but they have said that this is the driest year right now that we've had in California since 1580, which was 150 years before George Washington was born. But when you look further back in the historic record, if you go back 1,000 years, there have actually been 2 droughts in California that lasted more than 200 years. Both of those were a long time ago. One ran from about 800 to about 1,000, and another one ran from about 1,100 to about 1,300. And there are multiple droughts in the 1600s and 1700s that lasted 10 to 20 years. What's a little troubling is that California now has 38 million residents. It has the largest agricultural industry of any in the United States. And the entire water system has never been tested by a drought close to that scale. The longest droughts that we've had have only lasted 6 years in the 20th century. The Dust Bowl drought from 1928 to 34 and the 1987 to 1992 drought. So we have no idea if along one of these mega droughts occurred, how we'd be able to come through it. Although I've written a little bit about what those scenarios might look like.
This is not just a scare tactic. It's something that people have to be aware of, and it's good that you're doing the work you are doing. You mentioned the extended drought in California. I don't know how many are aware that there is speculation that the drought of more than 200 years in South America may have led to the demise of the Mayan population.
Oh, yeah. And there's some connection with Pueblo cultures in the 1200s, the Anasazi in the southwest. There was another culture in the Phoenix, the area that's now Phoenix, that disappeared during several of these periods. So there's no question that it has happened in the past. The thing to look at now, however, is that we are much more resilient. We have better technology. We have the ability to measure when storms are coming. We have the ability to build reservoirs to catch water, to build deep wells, to build desalination plants. So we're not going to all run out of water and go extinct as a species in California, but it's important to remember two things. One, that we live in a very arid state. So most of California gets about 15 inches of rain a year. That's how much Los Angeles gets. That's how much Silicon Valley gets. That's the same amount of rain as Casablanca, Morocco. And last year, both of those places, Silicon Valley and Los Angeles, got 3 inches of rain each. So these are desert-like conditions to begin with. And so when you have a historically dry period, it really stresses the system. And then second, if we had a long-term drought, say 10 years or more, the group that would suffer the most by far would be agriculture. Basically, we would be having to fallow millions of acres of land. Many farmers would go out of business. Small towns in the Central Valley would have incredibly high unemployment rates. The federal government would bail them out to the tune of billions of dollars. And people on the coast and in the major cities, they would have conservation, but you know, water would still be there. It would come out of the tap. And you know, we can always do more conservation, and an absolute last-ditch need, we can always build desalination plants like they have in Saudi Arabia and Israel and other places.
So far, we've considered it far too expensive, the desalination plants, but it has a price tag of $15 million or more per small plant.
Oh, yeah. There's one under construction right now in Carlsbad near San Diego. It's the largest one ever built in North America. It's a $1 billion project. It'll be done in 2016. But normally, desalination is far too expensive for taxpayers. There are many, many cheaper ways to provide more water at a lower cost for taxpayers. So, for example, the water that is pumped out of the delta that goes to many cities costs about $400 an acre foot. An acre foot is the amount of water that a family of five uses in a year. So that's $400. You can build a recycled water plant where you're taking sewage and treating it and then using it for irrigation and freeing up potable water. You can build one of those for about $1,000 an acre foot. Desalination costs about $2,000 an acre foot. You can do conservation for about $200 an acre foot. And what I mean by that is water agencies already are and will continue to offer rebates for people who put in low flush toilets, who replace dishwashers and clothes washers, and who remove their lawns and replace them with drought tolerant plants. The money spent on those programs frees up far more water at a much lower cost than you can get by building desal.
Feasibility, though. How many of our population is really going to cut back to use a special nozzle on their hose or those minor things that we hardly even think of while we're in the act, and that is washing our cars? Is that really going to make that big of a difference?
Well, yes and no. Farmers in California use 80% of the state's what they call developed water. That's the water that people use that doesn't flow through rivers to the ocean. So all 38 million people are using about 20% of the water. So population growth is not actually the main driver of demand for water in California, even though a lot of people think it is. There's this big misconception that people in the north have that Los Angeles and places in the south are taking all the water and, you know, using it for their lawns and their swimming pools, but that's really not the case. The entire city of Los Angeles uses about 2% of the state's water supply. In many urban areas in the state, including Los Angeles and including Silicon Valley here, are using the same amount of water in terms of actual gallons as they were 30 years ago, even though the population has grown considerably over that time by about a third. The reason is that when you think about old, inefficient appliances, you know, an old toilet was anywhere from 5 to 8 gallons per flush. A new toilet is 1 gallon per flush. So as you offer incentives for people to do that, you pay them money, or in some cases, cities have actually required that as a condition of when you sell a house, you have to replace the old toilet with a new toilet. I live in the city of Santa Cruz. We've had that law for more than 10 years. The day that I bought my house, a guy was running down to Home Depot and bolting a new toilet into the floor so he could sign the right piece of paper. So that's one way to do it, is through incentives. If the drought gets worse, we'll see a lot of mandatory rationing in cities. And in those cases, people remember 1976-77 or 1987-92 droughts. Cities send out so-called water cops to drive around. And if they see you watering in the daytime when you're not supposed to, you get a fine. Cities can also set limits on how much water people can use per capita, or they can require a 10 or a 20% reduction from your use last year. And if you use more, just like with the utilities, like Pacific Gas and Electric, your bill goes up to a much higher rate of payment. So there's lots of ways to get people to do it. But in general, I think most people realize there's a drought. I think most people generally want to do the right thing, and they'll try to conserve. And there are a lot of easy ways you can do it, too, that aren't very painful at all. I mean, the three best ways to conserve water in your house are, number one, cut back on your irrigation of your lawn. A lot of people overwater their lawns in the winter. It's colder in the winter. Your grass doesn't need as much water. Second, check your house for leaks. You know, you can put dye in the toilet tank and see if your toilet's leaking and other appliances are leaking. Finally, you can put a bucket in the shower so that when you take a shower, the extra water fills up the bucket, and then you use that bucket to water plants outside. A lot of people in Northern California have been doing that in the last few months that I've been talking to, and it works quite well.
There have been several stories over the past few weeks reporting that small towns in California are very close to running out of water. Willits in the northern portion of the state has apparently been hit the hardest, but you don't hear about this happening in areas with larger populations.
You know, there was a story out that I wrote how there are 17 communities that have a 60 to 120-day supply of water left before they run out. These are small towns, and often they don't have any kind of backup supply. But, you know, the bottom line is when you look at the effect of the drought so far in California, ranchers are being hit the worst because they don't have the grass to feed their cattle. They're having to sell off herds. Second is farmers. They're not getting deliveries of water from the Delta and other places, so they're having to pump groundwater and fallow fields. Third are small water districts that don't have backup water supplies. They might only have one little reservoir or one little well, and as that goes dry, some of them will actually have to truck water in as they're trying to get emergency connections with pipes to larger communities. And then finally are larger communities. You know, big cities are doing pretty well, and very few of them have mandatory rationing right now because they've been conserving a lot over the last 30 years. Many of them have built backup supplies. They've built new reservoirs. They've done groundwater storage. Here in San Jose, we're just finishing building a $50 million wastewater recycling plant that will provide 10% of the water use in the area. So they've learned from the 77 drought and the 87-92 drought that you need to plan ahead. But eventually, if it doesn't rain much more over the next year or two, even the big cities will be in a more dire situation. Farmers use 80% of the water in the state. The economy in the urban areas of California is some of the strongest anywhere in the United States. I mean, Silicon Valley is growing absolutely steadily. There's a lot of IPOs here. Unemployment rate's low. People are moving here. And as I say, we're not even doing mandatory rationing in any of these cities yet, because there's plenty of water in them. It's the farmers who use 80% who are just, their economic model is built on having large amounts of cheap water. And so as the drought continues, there will certainly be less farming in California. And if you had a long-term drought, there would be less production. We'd have to import more food from other countries and other, other states. But it will not affect the population in Arizona, Nevada, any of these places, because the engines of the economy of these places, where most of the jobs come from, actually use very little water. You know, Hollywood doesn't use much water. Silicon Valley doesn't take much water to make software.
Well, I've also heard this about Las Vegas. They don't use a lot of water.
Right. Well, now they're in an even drier area. But even so, I think if you research it, you'll probably find that agriculture uses maybe 70% of the water in Nevada. As I mentioned, you can always do a lot more extreme conservation. You can require, for example, nobody put in a lawn in any new house. No lawn watering. And lawn watering is 50% of every home's use a year. You can set all sorts of very strict limits to get the most residential use cut by 50% or more. And most people wouldn't even feel that much.
Yeah.
But for a farmer, if you cut a farmer 20 or 30%, they're in big trouble. That means their production goes down 20 or 30%. They might not make a profit. So the solution ultimately is to build more reservoirs to store more water in wet years. They have to be off-stream reservoirs that don't kill endangered salmon. And we have to have cities work with farmers to put in more water-efficient agricultural practices, mm-hmm. more drip irrigation, which cuts water use 40% per acre, more lining farm canals with clay so that the water doesn't seep down on hot days. But we're a long way from becoming the Anasazi. And remember also, these coastal areas are the richest communities in the United States. They will build desal if they have to.
Yeah, no matter what the cost.
That's right, no matter what the cost.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking.
People driving Teslas aren't going to move to Buffalo.
Undoubtedly.
No offense to Buffalo.
Yeah, right.
Hey, nice talking to you.
Nice talking with you. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I've been talking with environment writer for the San Jose Mercury News and managing editor for KQED, Paul Rogers. Check out his website at mercurynews.com/drought and kqed.org/science. Up next, I'll be talking with climate scientist, director of the National Resource Defense Council Climate and Clean Air Program, Dan Lassoff. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, with climate scientist, director of the National Resources Defense Council Climate and Clean Air Program, Dan Lassoff. Thank you for joining the show.
Sure. Happy to be here.
We need to start with what is going on with our weather, and that's such a broad question, but we have snowstorms, ice storms, cold, chilling weather in the Northeast, and we have extreme drought in the West, Southwest. On the one hand, we have people saying, what do you mean global warming? Look at Pennsylvania. And on the other, we have folks saying, we are facing severe climate change. 90-some-odd% of scientists agree it is changing.
I think it's very important to recognize that the weather we're experiencing in the eastern United States is not necessarily representative of what's going on around the world. So we are, in fact, having a real winter in the eastern U.S. for the first time in quite a few years. But when you look around the world, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration just reported that January of 2014 globally is among the hottest years on record. As you mentioned, the western U.S. is both hot and extremely dry. The fact is that we are changing the climate by loading up our atmosphere with heat-trapping carbon dioxide and other pollutants. And we're seeing the effects of that in different ways, in different places, and at different times. But the basic trend is towards warmer temperatures overall, when you look at the globe as a whole, towards more intense storms when it does storm, so when it rains, it pours, and more severe droughts when it's not raining, because the atmosphere holds more moisture, which means it can dump bigger snowstorms or bigger, more intense rainstorms when it is raining. But it also means that when it's dry, the ground dries out more quickly. Water evaporates faster. And so that is the intensification of extreme events that we're seeing due to heat trapping pollution.
Something that's very interesting to observers like myself, with the reference to meteorological predictions, is the reliability. It's always been a case of about 30%, which is pretty good. However, over the past year or 2 years even, it's become less so. And some scientists are looking at that and saying, well, this is because of the jet stream. That speeds up and slows down according to the melting of the polar ice caps. And therefore, we have unpredictability even more so than we had before.
Well, I think there are a few things going on. First of all, winter in general is more variable than summer. So it's harder to make predictions, and there's more variation from week to week and from year to year in winter weather. And so recent experience, I think we're all seeing that. The meander of the jet stream certainly is a factor in the extreme cold weather penetrating into the southern United States this year. I mean, we're seeing the so-called polar vortex, rather than being a nice circle confined to a region around the North Pole, is really dipping way down even into northern Florida. That's unusual, but it's not unprecedented. Some scientists believe and have published papers saying that that is related to climate change due to heat trapping pollution, but there's not really a consensus on that specific point. There is, on the other hand, a consensus on the broader point that carbon pollution is changing our climate, it is warming the Earth as a whole, and it is causing more extreme drought and more extreme storms.
For those just tuning in, talking with climate scientist Dan Lassoff, director of the NRBC Climate and Clean Air Program. You have a website you'd recommend, Dr. Lassoff, for those who would like to do more research on this?
Sure. Our website is www.nrdc.org. We have a lot of information on climate change and solutions to climate change. Another really good website for more basic science information is climatecentral.org.
Good.
Those are two of many that are available.
What we're going to be hearing more of is the naysayers that are saying, well, we've had extreme droughts before, we've had harsh weather before, and if you go back a few hundred years, you're going to look at maybe 100 drought years in the state of California or 100 years of flooding in New York. So how can this be any different?
Well, what we have not had before ever in human history is 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. And we have that now because of combustion of coal, oil, and natural gas, the fossil fuels. That has been adding carbon dioxide to our atmosphere. You know, when I started studying this, we were talking about 350 parts per million and how extraordinary that was compared with what the levels were before fossil fuel combustion became a major activity, which was the natural level around 280 parts per million during the sort of history of the development of human civilization. Now it's 400 parts per million, and we're just looking at 350 in the rearview mirror. That changes, frankly, everything in our climate. Carbon dioxide is a very powerful heat-trapping pollutant, and it is making droughts more intense. It's leading to bigger storms. Of course, we had droughts before. We had storms before. But the excess carbon pollution in our atmosphere is putting our weather on steroids.
Is that man-made? Is it something that we should be controlling? Because there are those who are going to say it's not man-made. This is a natural evolutionary cycle. In fact, we've had higher levels in centuries past.
It absolutely is man-made. There's no question that the increase in carbon dioxide levels from about 280 parts per million to 400 parts per million is a result of burning coal, oil, and natural gas, and to a lesser extent due to deforestation. There really is no dispute at all in the scientific community about that. You may have an occasional person claim otherwise, but no credible scientist would dispute that. And it is having an effect on our climate that has been observed. So, yes, it's man-made, and yes, there's something we can do about it. We need to limit the total amount of carbon pollution we put into our atmosphere, and we do that primarily by shifting our energy sources from coal and oil and natural gas to wind and solar and energy efficiency. And we're doing that in the United States over the last few years. We've made significant progress. Our emissions are down about 10% from their peak. We just need to do much more. We need to do it systematically, and we need to do it more quickly than we have been doing.
At the same time, we're hearing a lot about fracking and U.S. oil independence. So is that a contradiction?
Well, it can be. You know, we really do need to transition away from use of all fossil fuels. I think we have to focus particularly on how we're using fossil fuels, replacing the dirtiest coal-fired power plants with wind and solar, for example, is the fastest and the biggest impact we can make, along with energy efficiency, which reduces the need for any fossil fuel consumption. We certainly need to make sure that we're not continuing to invest billions and billions of dollars to develop fossil fuels that we really can't afford to burn. You know, at the same time, obviously, there is economic incentives in the U.S. to develop fossil fuels, and so energy companies will do that if what they're doing is replacing imported fossil fuels with domestically produced fuels. You know, that's not going to change the overall effect on the atmosphere. But that's a short-term issue about sort of where it's being produced. The bottom line is that about 80% of the fossil fuels that exist in the ground need to stay in the ground if we're going to avoid catastrophic climate change.
Is there a reason you haven't mentioned nuclear power here? Is that a possibility of working in favor of lowering the contamination and pollution?
You know, I didn't mention nuclear power because it's not a source of energy that's growing in the United States. Clearly, it is providing about 20% of our electricity. It's been providing about that same amount for a couple of decades, and that is electricity that doesn't generate carbon pollution, although it generates other kinds of risks. It's a very expensive way to make electricity, and I don't see it contributing to reducing our fossil fuel consumption significantly over the next 10 or 15 years, which is a time when we need to really make a huge amount of progress.
Let's hope we do for both sides, that is, East and West Coast. Well, Dr. Lassoff, thanks so much. I appreciate your time sincerely.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Appreciate the conversation.
Absolutely. I've been talking with Dr. Dan Lassoff with the National Resource Defense Council Climate and Clean Air Program Scientist. Check out their website at nrdc.org. My first guest, Paul Rogers, with the San Jose Mercury News and KQED. His websites, mercurynews.com/drought and kqed.org/science. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, do write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.